Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. It's Wednesday, November 6, 2019, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Last night's elections were good for Democrats. They now occupy all statewide offices in Virginia and control Virginia's legislature, seemingly solidifying the state's transition to blue status. Democrats picked up the Kentucky governor's mansion and kept the Mississippi governor's race to around 6 points. Will we look back at a year from now and see yesterday as a bellwether, a harbinger, or an outlying data point? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's a communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, Joya Jefferson Neary. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
As always, thank you for joining us. So let's start with Virginia. There's been a fairly dramatic and rapid transition from red to purple to blue. Your thoughts?
Well, as I saw on someone's social media post today, Virginia, blue looks good on you. And I think it is, I think it's a lot of what's happening to Virginia politics. Not just, I mean, Virginia's population. Virginia's population for the last 150 years has pretty much been the same people, the descendants of people who were the landowners in Virginia, one generation after another. Now people all over the country over the last 30 years have been migrating to Virginia. I think they're younger, they're more politically progressive, they're more affluent, which tends to be the demographics of the Democrats. And that's proven by what happened in the vote around the Washington, D.C. suburbs and the Richmond suburbs. And then we know the affluence of Charlottesville. So I think the demographics of Virginia have changed over the last 30 years. I also think it didn't hurt the Democrats at all that a lot of the policies around reproductive rights, immigration rights, and just personal integrity out of the White House really was a turnoff to the new population of Virginia.
Some analysts are seeing this as a suburban versus small town, rural, and exurban area. And to your point about what's going on in surrounding Richmond and RICO and other counties around Richmond, what we see happening in Fairfax and in other counties outside of Washington, D.C. Are you seeing this as suburban versus small town rural politics?
I don't think it could be just suburban for the entire legislature to go blue. I think every pundit in the country, in major newspapers, television today, and radio have been saying that that is it. It's suburban. But I don't think you turn the whole state around over a generation. Just having suburbanites make the decision.
What about the discussion in terms of women and the role that women are playing? The latest Washington Post ABC News poll talked about the particularly suburban women, Trump versus former Vice President Joe Biden, suburban men, 51% Trump, 43% Biden. Among women, Biden 28 points ahead, 63-35. When matched against Elizabeth Warren, Trump leads suburban men 54-42, but loses among women 60%-34%. So they're talking about particularly college-educated white women. Do you see that being a determinant here? And what I find interesting in a lot of that conversation is they don't talk about African-American women.
Well, I think that you hit it on the head that it is college-educated women. Suburbia tends to be college-educated white women. But I think college-educated Black women would fall into those same numbers. They're not pulled out in that recent poll. I would guess they would fall into the same numbers that they would prefer to have Joe Biden than Donald Trump or Elizabeth Warren than Donald Trump. But I think that there is something significant about college-educated suburban women parting ways with their significant others and or men in general. I think it's an indication of where women are going in their own personal politics, in their own personal lives, and in the power of making their own decisions. Yeah, I know that probably my mother didn't vote differently than my father, but I think that would not be something that would be true of my daughter and her potential husband.
Mm-hmm.
Think independent. She would think independence. I think it's a bigger cultural decision indicator than just election.
In Virginia, I was surprised that the governor, Northam, and Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring blackface issues, coupled with Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax's rape claims, did not have greater impact. I know that none of them were on the ballot this election, but when these stories were breaking, many thought that those stories would have an impact on last night's elections. Your thoughts?
I think that we're in a different age. I think had this happened 25 years ago, they would have. Even though they happened back in February and March, when it was all the news. But I think between all of the scandal and outrage stories that come out of the White House, and we have a 24-hour news cycle that we didn't have 25, 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that things move fast now. You have to like have new information or you fall off the radar. And I think that there have been other blackface incidents that we have found out about since this one in March. And it's sort of like, suburban white women don't care. I don't know if young black people are really that outraged about it or surprised. And I think these things fall off. I think there are other issues that are greater now in people's lives than are health care, reproductive rights, immigrant rights. People want to know about their jobs, the economy. And we're not really distracted by a lot of the cultural discourse that happened before. I mean, we know what Donald Trump said in that Access Hollywood trailer, and it didn't lose him an election. People are moving on faster and are really digging into things that are of more significance in their personal lives.
I think you're absolutely right on that point. I think that the distance in time between when those stories broke and when the election took place is an element. I think also the fact that Northam and Fairfax and Herring were not on the ballot. So it dragging these issues into the election, because I know there were a few commercials that ran around the Fairfax issue, but they didn't really seem to resonate. Well, obviously, based upon the outcome of the election, people were much more concerned. And interestingly enough, in a state that historically has been as conservative as Virginia, access to abortion, gun rights, immigration, those were some very, very powerful kitchen table issues, and the election went blue.
And if you think about it, the Democrats weren't going to bring it up at all. It was not going to be in anybody's stump speech or talking point. The Republicans, they look at their hitch their wagon to the White House, to the present-day White House. Why would they bring up something immoral?
When you tend to paint with a broad brush, you tend to get some of that paint on your own shoes.
Exactly. That would take them down a rabbit hole.
They didn't want to go. Let's go from Virginia to Kentucky. The race in Kentucky, to me, is interesting. In Kentucky, Governor Matt Bevin, the Republican candidate, he, at least this show time, has refused to concede the election to his Democratic challenger, Attorney General Andy Beshear. With 100% of the precincts counted, Beshear is ahead by 5,300 votes. Now, let's not get this confused, folks. Kentucky is not turning from red to purple as a result of the apparent election of Beshear, whose father, Steve Beshear, served as governor before Bevin. As many Republicans, including the president, pointed out late yesterday, the rest of the statewide races went to the GOP. But with that said, and understanding that Bevin is an incredibly unpopular guy, Trump did go into Kentucky on Monday and campaign for Bevin. And Bevin championed Republican policy initiatives such as pension reform for state workers and requiring those who receive Medicaid to work for their benefits. These are some issues that have been championed by conservatives. So again, this is not a harbinger in Kentucky. It does not suggest that there's a major realignment in the bluegrass state. But I do believe that the outcome of this election for governor does deserve some analysis. Joya, your thoughts?
I think he didn't have, Beshear didn't have coattails. He couldn't pull it off for the rest of the state. But the fact that he ran on keeping the Affordable Care Act, keeping Obamacare, and won in Kentucky says a lot. That's why it needs and deserves analysis. Because he wasn't talking about Medicare for all. He was talking about let's stay with Obamacare. And he talked about a woman's rights. He talked about immigration rights. He did all of the Democratic talking points, except Elizabeth Warren, maybe. But he did all of the Democratic talking points, and he won.
Unlike Jim Hood in Mississippi, who's a pro-life, pro-gun Democrat and lost the governor's race in Mississippi, Beshear ran, to your point, as a Democrat.
Exactly. And I think that says something about Mississippi. They didn't want, if you're going to vote for a Republican, you want a Republican. You don't want a Democrat who sounds like a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's what it said was, it said one of two things in Mississippi, and I think we'll know more over the next week if we start to look at the numbers and the districts that he won and he lost. But I think it says one of two things. Either Mississippi is a Republican state, it's not going anywhere, or the Democrats stayed home because they didn't have a Democrat to vote for.
That's a very, very good point. Yes, you do have to run on the issues that are relevant in the districts that you're appealing to. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to run as who you are, because voters see fraud, voters sense fraud usually fairly quickly. So I think Joya, that's a great, great point. We're going to have to continue this at another point. I got to get out here. Joya Jefferson Neary, communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications. As always, you are so gracious with your time when we call. I truly, truly appreciate it. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Welcome, and I appreciate being able to share.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. U.S. congressional panel outlines next phase of dirty war on Syria. Occupy oil fields and block reconstruction. You can find this story at the Gray Zone Project. Its author is a journalist, writer, and filmmaker. He is the assistant editor of The Gray Zone and the producer of the Moderate Rebels podcast, which he co-hosts with editor Max Blumenthal. He is Ben Norton. Ben, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So the president was really clear last week while announcing Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's demise. Quote, "We are leaving soldiers to secure the oil, and we may have to fight for the oil. It's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they'll have a hell of a fight. But there's a massive amount of oil, and we're securing it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it stops ISIS, because ISIS got tremendous wealth from that oil. We've taken it. It's secured. Number two, and again, somebody else may claim it, but either we'll negotiate a deal with whoever is claiming it, if we think it's fair, or we'll militarily stop them very quickly." You write that Dana Stroll, a longtime U.S. diplomat who oversaw a congressional mandated study of Syria, outlined the four-pronged plan for what she called the new phase of the war. What is this four-pronged plan, and why do you at the Gray Zone find all of this to be so significant?
Absolutely. Well, of course, we should go back a little bit before we talk about the current phase. Since 2011, there's been an international war going on in Syria. It's often referred to as a civil war, but that's really misleading. From day one, many global players were involved in this conflict. Even before day one, before this began in March 2011, this current conflict, the U.S. has a long history, and other countries, but primarily the U.S., of funding opposition groups, especially Islamist opposition groups. So it's no surprise that after the decades of supporting these groups, and then in the past several years, that the war led to the rise of these extremist Islamist groups like ISIS.
It was a proxy war.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the U.S. and its allies, and we should keep in mind that the Western allies involved in this war are themselves far from great beacons of democracy. We're talking about Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy, Qatar, and Turkey. Turkey itself is, you know, an authoritarian-leaning country. These were the allies. And they also supported ISIS. There's so much evidence showing this. And, you know, you mentioned that Baghdadi is dead, which is, of course, good news. Although we have a lot of reasons to be skeptical about the U.S. government story, just as the U.S. government story about killing bin Laden was later proven by the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh to be a fake story. There's a lot of, you know, suspicious details about this new case. You know, supposedly this dog chases Baghdadi, blows himself up. Anyway, but the point we should keep in mind that the media is not stressing, missing for the forest for the trees, is that Baghdadi was allegedly in Idlib, Syria, which is the last remaining so-called rebel-held province in the country. So in order to understand the new phase of the war, we have to understand that the war is coming to an end. The Syrian government and its allies have won this war, and the U.S. and its allies lost the war. So while they are in the final stages, they're still trying to bleed the Syrian government of, you know, bleed the government in any way that they can and weaken the government. One of the ways they've been doing that is in Idlib here, which this is a province in the northwest of Syria that is controlled largely by a rebranded Al-Qaeda group, which is the largest Al-Qaeda affiliate since the 9/11 attacks and has been directly protected and empowered by the U.S. and its allies. And it's also, we should keep in mind these reports in the past few weeks that Baghdadi, not only was he in Idlib, this area that the U.S. has been protecting, but also his family members were in Turkey. So we should keep in mind while we're talking about the final phase of the war that this dirty war that's been going on, there's no shortage of scandals. And while it's true that maybe the U.S. did kill Baghdadi, the U.S. has a direct role in not only helping cultivate and arm indirectly through its other rebels that defected to ISIS, not only of really strengthening this group, but also, of course, Baghdadi was radicalized when he was tortured in a U.S. camp inside Iraq. So understanding the moment where we are now, the war has finally almost come to an end. The last remaining area, you know, the conflict with Turkey is a little more complicated, but in the Northeast, they're, you know, coming to a ceasefire and they're coming to an agreement. The last remaining area is this province Idlib. And still, the U.S. is pushing for a new phase. And that new phase, as I talk about in my article, is a four-pronged plan that involves the continued military occupation of the resource-rich, oil-rich, economic powerhouse region of Syria, where most of the oil and also wheat and gas reserves are. The second part of this war is diplomatic isolation of Damascus, of preventing the U.S. and other countries from returning to Syria, reopening their embassies. The third aspect is sanctions. And we can talk more about the devastating impact of the economic sanctions, which have really hurt average civilians and caused fuel shortages, food shortages, And then finally, the last phase, and probably the most sadistic of all, is that now these U.S. government officials are openly saying that their goal is to prevent reconstruction in Syria in the majority of the country, which is controlled by the government. So effectively, they're collectively punishing the entire civilian population, really without any regard for the effects on civilians, because all they want, they have a chess. They see this conflict as a kind of chessboard. That's their view. And what they want to do is demonize, weaken, and destabilize the government itself. You know, and the people be damned. They're not concerned about the people.
You mentioned Dana Stroll in your article, and it's important for people to understand she's a Democrat. So the assumption would be if people were to subscribe to the stereotypes and the general narrative, people would assume that this is really a right-wing conservative Republican venture. But it is not that way at all.
Not at all, unfortunately. And what this shows is that until recently, basically all Democrats and most Republicans on foreign policy and war were marching in lockstep agreement. Of course, we can think about the fact that Hillary Clinton supported the Iraq War. It was really more recently, I mean, there are always a few exceptions, but more recently, you have this left wing that has emerged and is growing within the Democratic Party of people like Bernie Sanders, well, who's technically not a Democrat, but also Ilhan Omar, who just gave a speech denouncing Western imperialism, using the I word imperialism, which is almost never discussed in U.S. politics. You have people like Tulsi Gabbard. You also have, you know, other progressives, Alexandria mm-hmm. Ocasio-Cortez to a lesser degree, who are trying to push for a new foreign policy. Ro Khanna has been an important leader on this. And what's happening, though, is that still when it comes to issues like Syria, the vast majority of the Democratic Party establishment is still in agreement with Republicans. And you mentioned Dana Stroll, who is the co-chair of a congressionally mandated group called the Syria Study Group. This was created by Congress, and it was appointed with a dozen members by Congress, half Republicans, half Democrats, as a bipartisan group to basically draft the new plan for this final phase of the war in Syria. Now that they've accepted that the U.S. has essentially lost the military war, it's moving into an economic war. And what's interesting is that who did Congress appoint? Congress went, you know, they're in Washington. They went to all of the think tanks on K Street and throughout Washington, and they picked people at these hawkish, neoconservative, arms industry-funded think tanks, many of which are also funded by Gulf monarchies, if not the U.S. government itself. And they picked some Democrats and Republicans who are from these think tanks. But even though some are Democrats and some are Republicans, on war and foreign policy, they all pretty much agree with this bipartisan foreign policy consensus that Ilhan Omar has correctly called Western imperialism, supporting Western imperialism.
And you mentioned the four-pronged plan. Prong number one, U.S. military occupation of Syria's resource-rich economic powerhouse. And it's important for people to understand here that this is really a war crime. And the United Nations is very clear on this. They call it pillaging. And pillaging is a war crime. You cannot use your military to capture resources in the course of war. We're not hearing any of this being discussed in corporate mainstream media.
Not at all. It's absolutely a war crime. And I would go even further and say that really, in general, the U.S. war on Syria is the gravest crime of all under international law, which is the crime of aggression. This is an undeclared war that the U.S. has been waging, an aggressive act of war against an independent, sovereign foreign nation. The U.S. has, under international law, the U.S. has absolutely no right to wage this war. Under domestic law, this war has never been authorized. It's one of the seven wars the U.S. is currently waging, of course, on Muslim-majority countries. And it has completely, you know, aside from the fact that it's illegal, which is, of course, it's a huge scandal in its own right, but it has also devastated Syria and unleashed the largest refugee crisis since World War II. Really, I mean, the actual numbers are, you know, not entirely known, but more than 5 million, probably 6 million refugees have been created because of this war. That's not considering the millions more who didn't leave Syria, but who have been internally displaced in the country. And what's so disturbing is in my report, I talk about this congressionally mandated Syria study group panel, and this woman, Dana Stroll, who was the Democratic co-chair, who oversaw this study of this new Syria war plan, she says in this event, she says, we own, the language she uses is own, this kind of neocolonial rhetoric. We own one third of Syrian territory, which is the oil rich, wheat rich region, which that she calls correctly the economic powerhouse. And then she says, the rest of Syria is rubble. That's her language. She calls it rubble. And then she follows it up saying, Syria and its allies, Russia and Iran, want to rebuild those areas that are rubble. We don't want them to. We are holding this line, she says, and preventing reconstruction and assistance from going into the country, blocking the Syrian government from getting finance, access to capital on the international stage. So this is collective punishment of the entire civilian population, which is also a war crime. Sanctions and economic war are not an alternative to war. They are another form of war that is sometimes just as deadly as dropping bombs, except when we actually do see the people killed by the bombs, which is not often, but when we do see them, what we never see are the thousands of civilians who die because they can't access medicine and medical equipment and food and homes because sanctions and economic war are preventing their countries from rebuilding and buying these basic necessities.
As we get out, what are the three things that you want the reader to walk away from your piece? And let me say again, it's entitled U.S. Congressional Panel Outlines Next Phase of Dirty War on Syria, Occupy Oil Fields and Block Reconstruction. You can find this at the Gray Zone. What is it, Ben Norton? What are the three things that you want the audience to walk away from having a better understanding of?
That's a great question. The first is that these U.S. wars are nothing, they have nothing to do with freedom and democracy. They're not about supporting freedom and democracy. They're, as with any empire, they're about expanding control economically, getting access to natural resources, preventing adversaries from being able to function. So that's the first important point. The second important point is that Trump claims that he's going to try to end this war, but he's not ending the war. He's actually just changing the phase of the war. He's still openly admitting that the U.S. is stealing Syria's own resources to try to destabilize and weaken the country. That is a war crime. The war is not ending. It's simply changing form. And then the final point is that this bipartisan foreign policy consensus needs to be challenged. And that's why it's very important to have these new progressives who are maybe not even Democrats or who are Democrats, people like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and Bernie, who are pushing back against that warmongering, imperialist, bipartisan consensus. And also, to be fair, you know, I'm a progressive, but to be fair to people who are more conservative, there are also libertarians who are inconsistent. Rand Paul has been consistent against war, and there are some other figures. So there needs to be. The third point is that people really need to push back against this pro-war bipartisan consensus and push for new independent policies that support peace and diplomacy instead of more destruction.
Ben Norton, U.S. Congressional Panel Outlines Next Phase of Dirty War on Syria, Occupy Oil Fields and Block Reconstruction. Ben, thanks so much for your time this evening. Really appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
It's my pleasure, and thanks so much for covering this issue that the corporate media is ignoring. It's very important.
Thanks, man. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. President Macron from France. In China, President Xi hailed $15 billion trade contracts as strong signal of free trade. French President Macron and Chinese leader Xi Jinping have announced fresh trade contracts worth $15 billion. Amid the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China, Macron and Xi also agreed to double down on climate change, We really have to ask ourselves the question here, folks. What do the French know that the U.S. don't know? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the new, just released book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. He's Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Good evening.
So French President Emmanuel Macron and Chinese President Xi Jinping announced major trade contracts in Beijing today worth $15 billion. Deals were agreed in aeronautics, energy, and agriculture. 20 French companies received approval to export poultry, which I think is raised here in the United States, pork, which I believe is raised here in the United States, beef, all of this going to China. How does all this get done? I mean, I guess this is proof positive that the French are lovers, not fighters.
Well, it's also proof that the China is covering itself here as far as the trade war with Trump is concerned. You know, a lot of hoopla about a mini deal here between China and U.S. a couple of weeks ago. But that deal is not closed. And even if it is, it's only a very minor part based on agreements that had been made some time ago or concessions offered by China some time ago. It's a mini deal. But the problem with the mini deal is that Trump has not reduced the tariffs on China, and China is not going to agree even to the mini deal unless there's some backtracking by Trump on his tariffs on China. So the news just came out today that it doesn't look like that mini deal is going to get signed this month in November. And administration officials are saying, well, sometime, somewhere in December. That's not a good sign. And of course, you know, Trump really wants that deal to quick start China purchases of U.S. farm goods. And what Macron is doing here in, you know, this deal, it's primarily European agricultural goods that they're talking about. China really needs to step up its purchases of agricultural goods, particularly pork, because they're having problems with their pork production over there. And I think also just today, Canada now is jumping back in and signaling that it's going to negotiate on farm goods or increase its farm goods. So China is protecting its itself here and seeking alternative markets to purchase farm goods. And that's not a good sign for a Trump-China deal here.
You're correct. Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau announced a reopening of Canadian beef and pork exports to China. Now, understanding that the U.S. market is an incredibly desirable market, and understanding that American exports, such as poultry, beef, and pork, are desirable all around the world. Is this deal with France and with the Canadians reopening their beef and pork exports to China, is this possibly a removal of markets the same way that the soybean market that the U.S. was exporting to China, China has now moved those contracts, to Brazil?
Yeah, there's purchases from right. Brazil as well.
Right. So are we looking at the potential, if this trade war continues to go on between the United States and China, that some of these beef, pork, and poultry markets could go away for the U.S. the same way that the soybean markets have gone away?
Absolutely. And I think China is not going to let itself be vulnerable to Trump in the U.S. market. Whether it is a deal or not, I think they're going to attempt to develop other markets elsewhere in the world as a protection against future Trump moves on trade. Because this trade war and tech war behind it is not ending here with the mini deal. This thing's going to go on. This is a long-term thing between China and the U.S. And China, of course, is going to find other outlets to protect itself in a trade war with the U.S.
We also have, separate from this conversation, but Airbus is also now, signing agreements with China and opening plants or building in China to compete with Boeing.
Yeah, well, that's just another example of these many deals occurring here between Europe and China, because both Europe, although it hasn't been the brunt of Trump's trade war, they know it's coming. And, you know, they're looking for outlets in China. Germany exports a lot to China already. So there's already this basis for German-China trade and European-China trade. And both of them are, you know, beginning to develop this second channel here rather than be totally or so reliant on the United States. And unless Trump moves off of his tariffs with China, we're going to see a lot more of this. But even if he does and a mini deal is signed, and it'll take some move on tariffs on Trump's part, you know, China is and Europe are going to continue to develop the relationships.
President Xi said in a statement that the two leaders had, quote, sent a strong signal to the world about steadfastly upholding multilateralism and free trade, as well as working together to build open economies. Developing market access and partnerships between our companies is a priority. Macron said that today. Is that really a message to Donald Trump, a shot across his bow, sending a strong signal to the world? He's really sending a strong signal to Trump that you're not only losing the battle, you're losing the war.
Yes, well, folks should understand that this is not Trump and Trump's trade war. Trump's trade actions have the full support of most of the business class in the United States. And so what's going on? Well, what's going on is the global trade and global production is slowing down. The latest data, I think, show a contraction of global trade volume. What the U.S. trade war, and it's not just Trump's trade war, is all about is to restructure the global trading relationships here, worldwide, to the benefit of U.S. Corporations, and in the light of the slowing global economy, to protect their share, U.S. share of the slowing global economy. That's what this restructuring of global trade relationships is all about. And it's not the first time the U.S. has done this. Part, however, of evidence that the neoliberal regime in the U.S. is weakening, and Trump and U.S. Corporations are trying to restructure it so that they can remain dominant for at least another decade here. So this is a long-term strategic thing going on, and it's not just Trump. It's U.S. Capitalists in general who are fully behind what he's doing.
But isn't a big part of this problem, not so much that the restructuring is taking place or not so much that the restructuring needs to be done, it's the manner in which the Trump administration is trying to get it done. It's the ham-fisted, bludgeoning, we're going to negotiate, but you're going to concede to my demands before we get to the table style of negotiations. That's a big problem that I see here, and China isn't going to go for that.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's the manner in which it's being done, which is very ham-fisted, like you say. But it just reveals that today in 2019, the U.S. is not as dominant and able to force other countries and economies to do what it wants simply by sitting down and negotiating. You know, Ronald Reagan did it, but he didn't have to engage in the tariffs and the threats and so forth, because the U.S. was in a lot stronger position in the 80s vis-a-vis Japan and Europe than Trump and the U.S. is today vis-a-vis China and Europe. So the U.S. position is weaker.
As we get out here, I just remember candidate Donald Trump telling us very, very clearly negotiating with China was going to be simple. United States, that President Obama had been played for a fool and that he was not going to be that dumb. He was going to walk in there. He was going to tell Xi Jinping what to do. And we were going to wrap this up in a couple weeks. Well, folks, it ain't happening.
And he said he was going to bring jobs back, too. And he hasn't done that either.
Bring jobs back. As always, Dr. Jack Rasmus, thank you, sir. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more, still more, on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Iran, to begin injecting uranium gas into 1,044 centrifuges, this is the latest step away from the 2015 nuclear deal. It puts more pressure on EU signatories to counteract crippling U.S. sanctions. My next guest has written a great piece entitled Confronting the Islamic Republic, Trump versus Rhodes Roundtable. He writes, there seems to be solid disagreements among the circles of power about how much to escalate tensions with Iran. The basis for these differences and what they represent is worth examining carefully. And that's what he does. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age. Caleb Maupin. Caleb, welcome back.
Sure. Glad to be here as always.
So, what's the correlation between Cecil Rhodes's roundtable and where we are today?
Well, Dr. Carol Quigley, who was kind of a mentor of U.S. President Bill Clinton, was an academic who consulted and was hired by the U.S. Department of Defense. He did a lot of writing, and one of his books is called The Anglo-American Establishment. And in that book, he lays out that, you know, at the time of his death, Cecil Rhodes, who was a big advocate of British imperialism, Rhodesia, which Zimbabwe before it wants independence, was called Rhodesia, named after Cecil Rhodes. He created the Rhodes Scholar Program, and he laid the basis for what is now the Council on Foreign Relations. He essentially, in his will, called for the creation of what he referred to as a secret society that would be maintaining the ideals of the British Empire. It eventually just kind of degenerated into, at first it was called the Round Table, and it was just an association. It wasn't a secret society in the scary sense. No password, no secret code, but an association of people who shared the outlook of some of the wealthiest people in Britain. And at first it was called the Round Table, and out of that we get the Council on Foreign Relations, and we get a lot of different institutes. We get the Rockefeller think tanks, and it was just kind of a network of globally oriented thinkers, and they represent a very powerful faction in U.S. politics today. Many of the most prominent voices in American politics, almost all of them are part of the Council on Foreign Relations. It's where U.S. foreign policy strategy is developed over the long term. It's also where a lot of academic research takes place, and it constitutes one axis within the U.S. power structure, both the business community and the government agencies.
How does all that now tie to the military-industrial complex and their whole idea of peace through strength, and also with the oil companies talking about a drill now?
Well, that's what is quite interesting, because you'll notice that Trump's strategy on Iran is a huge break with the strategy of the Obama administration. U.S. President Obama favored softening sanctions, negotiating, created the nuclear deal along with John Kerry. And the idea was to get closer to Iran, increase American influence in Iran, de-escalate tensions, and obviously to then gradually increase influence of the United States in Iran to the point that perhaps maybe some political unrest could lead to regime change. Whereas if you look at what the Trump administration is doing, they seem to have the opposite effect. They seem to be doing everything they can to escalate tensions, whether it's ripping up the nuclear deal, whether it's, continued provocative moves, dramatic sanctions, declaring the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran to be terrorists. The Trump administration is doing everything it can to escalate tensions with Iran. And if you look at who Donald Trump's backers are, this makes sense. One of the main supporters of pro-Trump political voices in the United States is the DeVos Foundation. That's the wealth being distributed of Betsy DeVos, the educational secretary. And they fund a lot of pro-Trump activism and pro-Trump political voices in the United States. And they are also military contractors. The more the countries surrounding Iran that are aligned with the United States, like Kuwait, like Saudi Arabia, the more they purchase weapons, the more military contractors are deployed to the Middle East, the more money the Betsy DeVos family is going to make. You look at Home Depot and the owners of Home Depot. They are tied in with defense contractors, have quite a bit of money to be made from weapons and other escalations. You look at the fracking companies, for example. The fracking companies are particularly worried right now because as much as Trump tries to keep the price of oil high, the price of oil keeps dropping, and they're already having difficulty paying back their loans. Wall Street is very, very worried about the fracking companies who continue to not consistently be paying back their loans. So if you put all of this factor in there, it seems like the strategy of escalating tension between the United States and Iran and the strategy of actually conducting regime change and overthrowing the Iranian government don't always coincide. There's a lot of money to be made for Trump's backers in the short term. When it comes to escalating tensions with Iran, but a strategy, a long-term strategy of regime change, as Obama carried out with Libya, where, you know, we will remember that with Libya, there was a softening, there was deals made, there was an opening up, there was an extension of American influence in Libya, and then a political crisis fomented that eventually brought down the government. That was a strategy of de-escalating, increasing American influence in the country, and then dividing the country, creating a political crisis. Whereas it seems that the Trump administration's strategy regarding Iran is to increase tension as much as possible in order to make profits for Trump's backers in the short term.
You write, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been in the crosshairs of the Eastern establishment since it was born in the 1979 revolution. The Iranian government came to power with slogans of neither East nor West, not capitalism, but Islam, and war of poverty against wealth. You go on to write, in essence, the non-Western, non-capitalist revolutionary government of the Islamic Republic is everything that Cecil Rhodes Society was established to oppose. And I think to your point about bringing Libya into the conversation, there are a number of countries that fit that description.
Indeed. And the strategy, again, is do you engage in soft power? Do you manipulate events within a country? Do you spread the influence of the West in order to create instability? Or do you just escalate military tensions with these countries in order to spend more money on weapons and eventually perhaps, you know, risk the danger of things exploding into a real hot war? That has been the divide, and the military-industrial complex had lots of money to make on wars in the short term and lots of money to make on selling weapons and escalating an arms race. But if you look at the Soviet Union, for example, right, a lot has been written, you know, giving Reagan's arms deals and spending credit for overthrowing the Soviet Union. But in reality, it's very apparent that the overthrow of the Soviet Union had a lot more to do with political turmoil in the Soviet Union of inroads being made by Western ideas spreading and by a very, very large percentage of the Soviet Communist Party being sympathetic to the United States. We saw the coup with Gorbachev. And if you look at it, it wasn't a military defeat that overthrew the Soviet Union. It was actually the efforts to create turmoil in the country, undermine faith in the leadership, divide the leadership. All of that played an important role. And this kind of mythology that the Soviet Union was brought down simply by Reagan, giving dramatic speeches and saying tear down that wall and spending a lot of money on nukes is just an obfuscation of reality, right? And these two strategies. The one strategy that you can associate with the Council on Foreign Relations and with Cecil Rhodes, this long-term strategy of rolling back any opposition to Western capitalism, maintaining the rule of Wall Street in London by destabilizing and eventually overthrowing any geopolitical competitor, versus the strategy of a lot of people who just have a lot of money to be made through escalating conflict, and in particular, the Israeli Likud Party, which, you know, is very much in the interest of the Israeli Likud Party to see tension with Iran go up. The more that Iran can be perceived as a threat, the stronger Netanyahu will be in Israel. And so do you want to benefit from short-term turmoil and escalation for short-term economic and political gain, or do you have a long-term strategy for actually overturning and overthrowing governments in the way of Wall Street? This division between foreign policy strategies and economic interests seems to almost define U.S. politics for the last few decades.
And you go on to write, the Islamic Republic has become a beacon of encouragement to other forces around the world who seek to end the rule of Western capitalism. And one of the things that I've been saying for a very long time is that an imperial hegemon such as the United States can never allow a country such as Iran, a country such as Haiti, a country such as Libya to successfully resist. That is the bully on the playground. The bully on the playground cannot allow that smaller kid to come and punch him in the face, because when that happens, the bully is no more.
Well, I would say that it's even more precise than that. It's simply a matter of not tolerating any competition. I believe, you know, when I was in Iran, I met many Iranians who were under the impression that if only Iranian leaders would not say nasty things about the United States, if only they would stop chanting death to America, if they would do that, then the United States would get friendlier to Iran and we could all be friends and be peaceful. But at the end of the day, the opposition to the Islamic Republic of Iran is not really rooted in anything the Iranian leaders say. It's rooted in the fact that Iran is an independent oil-producing country that exports oil on the international markets in competition with ExxonMobil, a primary funder of the Council on Foreign Relations, with British Petroleum, with Chevron. That seems to be the basis. You know, Iran, when it seized control of its oil resources in the 1979 revolution, it began using those oil profits to build up a state-run economy and to build their own car industries and their own aviation and their own steel manufacturing and to also send that money around the world to forces that were trying to resist the rule of Western capitalism, whether it was the Irish Republican Army or forces in Latin America or anywhere. I mean, Iranian oil is now, you know, the profits from Iranian oil aren't going to Wall Street bankers. It's going to many things that are against their interests. If Iran were poor and dependent, or if Iran were simply a vassal of the Rockefeller oil companies and such, as it was under the Shah of Iran, the oil was nominally nationalized under the Shah, but it was basically the de facto property of British and American bankers. But now that Iran is an independent economy that is competing, they are going to try and remove it from the market. I mean, let's not forget that Gaddafi, you know, in his final years was very, very friendly to the United States.
Very.
Obama as his little African son, all kinds of things were done to appease, but it's not about what they say, it's about what they do. And if you exist as a competitor, you are going to be targeted.
And as we wrap this up, we know that Gaddafi was trying to compete on a number of levels. He was trying to compete with the European Union. He was trying to develop his own currency. He was air raiding the desert. There were a number of very progressive things. Gaddafi saw himself as an African as opposed to seeing himself as an Arab. There were a number of things that Muammar Gaddafi was supporting and was implementing that were proven to be or would prove to be in direct competition with the United States, with the European Union, and with many of the other Arab countries. Caleb Maupin, got to stop you here. Fantastic, fantastic piece. Confronting the Islamic Republic, Trump versus Rhodes Roundtable. Where can people get it?
You can get it at my website, CalebMaupin.com, CalebMaupin.com.
Caleb, thank you very much. Really appreciate it, man. Hey, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.